Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
There was a big development in the Premier League because Tottenham opened their new stadium. Well, I say opened, it was technically a test event. They capped the attendance to 30,000, just half of what it is capable of. But at long last, 7 months later than planned, budget up to about £1 billion, the new Tottenham Stadium, official name TBC, has opened to some of the public. It was a pretty good day overall. I think there was a story in The Sun on Sunday morning suggesting that the corners, there wasn't enough room around the corner flags to take a good corner, you know, AstroTurf runoffs. To be honest, almost every stadium now has AstroTurf right up to the edge of the pitch just because it's a really run-on area, either by the assistant referee or by the substitutes. So it's actually easier just to have that. I don't think it's any worse than, say, Stamford Bridge, where the fans are right on top of you, or even the old White Hart Lane, where it was very difficult to really get any sort of run-up on a corner. So I think that's been overblown. And realistically, there don't seem to be many hitches, which is good news, because April the 3rd is the official date for the first game in the new Tottenham Stadium. And of course, if we have any problems with the test events, that will have to get pushed back, and goodness knows where they'll be moving games to. But nevertheless, there's an under-18 match between Tottenham and Southampton yesterday, not normally warranting 30,000 spectators, but let's face it, they weren't there to watch the football, were they? No, they were there to see their new 62,052-seater stadium. I'm told that attendance is to make sure that it's just a little bit bigger than Arsenal's, which is without a doubt one of the most petty things I've ever heard of. Home, they're already calling it, Tottenham fans. It's on the site of the old one, of course. They'll be taking the same routes in and out of the ground. They say they're upgrading the train stations around it, which it will need, by the way, because anyone who's ever been to White Hart Lane, old or new, knows it's a bit of a nightmare to get in and out of. Not necessarily worse than Wembley, which is equally terrible, and anyone who's ever spent any sort of time there knows that. But they will need to upgrade the train stations if they've got 60-odd thousand coming in every day instead of 30-odd thousand. It's, of course, in the same place. It's not the same stadium at all. I mean, it's like a spaceship, to be honest. Anyone who's ever seen the Atlanta Stadium where they had the Super Bowl, which is of a similar sort of generation of stadium as this one, it is like something's just landed on the site of the old stadium. There's some quite nice nods to the old place. There's a plaque in the concourse which is called the Centre Spot, and it's on the location of the old Centre Spot. The club shop's had a revamp, but it's basically in the same place and it's got the same name. It doesn't otherwise really feel like old Tottenham, though. And what I mean by that is this stadium is really supposed to drag Tottenham kicking and screaming into the 21st century. Spurs fans used to crow that the new Arsenal Stadium, 12 years ago that opened, it had no atmosphere and no trophies. But, and actually, as David Arnautovic said in the Times today, you can say that your old moth-eaten cardigan is comfortable, but when your rival walks in wearing a tuxedo, it's hard to feel smart. And he's absolutely right, really. Tottenham would herald the old White Hart Lane as better than the Emirates, but it was a pretty weak argument, wasn't it? Realistically, the Emirates was a more modern and more Premier League worthy stadium, and it was hard to feel smart. And that's kind of what's going on here, essentially. A smartening up. Alright, a very expensive one, and one that goes well beyond the likes of the Emirates, which at 12 years old is now starting to look a little outdated. In those 12 years, stadia have moved on a long way. But one of the reasons, though, that Arsenal and Manchester United are so profitable as football clubs is that their stadia are well-oiled money-making machines. White Hart Lane, with its wooden floorboards and cramped concourses and queuing for days, and quite often, actually, in the old White Hart Lane, in some of the stands, you would come out of your seat at half-time and join a queue, but you had no idea what you were queuing for because it snaked round a corner and you just sort of guess, is it bagels, is it beer, is it chocolate? You just got to the front and said, I'll have two of whatever you sell at this particular stand, please. Whereas modern stadia just aren't like that. So much more spacious, it's so easier to navigate. The longest bar in Europe, we understand, in the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. So White Hart Lane was probably once a modern stadium. In 1995, actually, Lord Sugar put a Jumbotron screen on the South Stand. It was the first to show the game live. It was a modern innovation. But It was a modern innovation in 1995. So I think time may have moved past it. The new place is entirely an innovation. The whole stadium. The man behind it, actually, is Christopher Lee. No, not that Christopher Lee, obviously. Sadly departed. But this Christopher Lee, who's a consultant with an architecture firm called Populous, and he's basically spent 6 years on the phone to Daniel Levy, which is not an enviable task, I can tell you. But he describes him as the most demanding client I've ever worked with, but in a positive way. I don't know how that can be positive. Like, the word demanding is very obvious what he means. But they basically went all over the world. They looked at the best venues and cherry-picked the best elements. It's a bit like building a squad, really, isn't it? You go all over the world, you look at what everyone else is doing, you say, oh, I love that, I love that, I love that. Unless you're Daniel Levy, of course, in which case you say, well, I'm not going to sign any players. Because he hasn't done that in a while. And that's kind of the point now. Is that Tottenham have built this fabulous new stadium. And it is a fabulous stadium. There's no doubt about that. You look at it from the outside, you look at it from the inside. The 17,500-seater wall, influenced by, of course, the great yellow wall at Dortmund. The acoustics are supposed to be spectacular. We'll see how that works out, by the way, because a lot of stadiums have boasted acoustics and they haven't always actually produced them. So we'll have to just wait and see on that one for Wednesday, April the 3rd. But they now need, with this great new stadium, with this great new pitch, with all the deals they've got, they're going to play rugby there, they're going to play American football there. They've got a pitch that rotates in and out. With everything that they've got, they need a squad to match it. Because football clubs, in the end, are about the team on the pitch. Much as everything that goes alongside it, the commercial deals, the mattress partners, the sponsorships, the stadia, the supporters clubs, much as that is important, the reason the fans are there is to watch the football team. And Tottenham haven't bought a player in over 12 months now. The squad has pretty much been put on hold because of the spend on the stadium and because of what that has required. Pochettino often talks about it like being on the front row of the grid in a Formula One race with a lesser car. That's what Tottenham have been doing. They've been punching well above their weight in terms of what they've achieved with the squad they've got. But it won't last. That catches up with you eventually. You can only exceed your expectations and potential for so long. The new stadium glow might help keep Harry Kane and Dele Alli. Might even convince Christian Eriksen to sign a new contract and stay and turn down Real Madrid. But only big checks will add talent to that group and help them compete on the level that they want to compete on. They want to be challenging for league titles. They want to be challenging for Champions Leagues. If they want to do that consistently, they must start spending on the squad as well. The wait is over. They're into the stadium. But the job is only half done.
Love Sport.
Time to talk a little bit of golf, because England's Paul Casey retained his Valspar Championship title last night. It was a thrilling denouement to the tournament in Florida. And we're going to speak to Dave Clark, sports journalist with Press Association Sport. Dave, just tell us a little bit about Paul Casey's final round. It wasn't all plain sailing, was it?
No, it wasn't. He was actually over par for his final round, and it looked like he might have possibly blown it on the 17th. He bogeyed the hole and found himself level with the American, Jason Kokrak, but he held his nerve down the last and his playing partner didn't, and that proved just enough in the end to squeak him over the line by one shot.
Now, people may not have heard of Jason Kokrak, but there was plenty of other players they would have heard of, not far behind Bubba Watson, John Rahm, Dustin Johnson. This was a strong field. How much of an indictment of Paul Casey's level is it that he was able to overcome them?
Yeah, it's a big win in a big tournament, and Paul Casey's a player who, with probably expected for nearly 20 years now to reach the very top of the game, and it's never quite happened for him. He's won some big tournaments, but he's not had that world number one moment like a lot of his contemporaries. He's not won a major. He's been in a couple of Ryder Cup teams, but fell out the picture there for a decade or so. So this is a big win, and hopefully he can kick on now. He's in his 40s and grab a couple of those really big titles.
I was going to ask you about the age thing, because he is 41 and he is the kind of guy who, as an English golf fan, we've heard about a lot. You know, he went over to the States as a young guy, but his name was always thrown around with the likes of Luke Donald and Lee Westwood as someone who could achieve. Do you think maybe he needed time and he needed a bit of maturity? Because there was something about that performance last night when he stuck his drive in the bunker off the tee. There was a real maturity and grit. Do you think that's come with age?
Yeah, possibly. I think, like a lot of the players, there was so much pressure heaped on that generation in the wake of the great European players of the 80s. And then we had a bit of a dry spell throughout the 90s where Colin Montgomery was clearly our best player, but he wasn't winning majors. And I think that generation with Donald and Casey and Westwood, they had a huge amount of pressure dumped on them, especially in majors. And that possibly chipped away at them a bit earlier in their careers. But I think most of them have gone on to what we can now see are relatively successful careers. They've earned huge amounts of money and they've won some big tournaments. But yeah, I think Paul Casey has definitely really developed as a player the last couple of years and improved since he got back to full fitness. He's committed to playing the PGA Tour rather than trying to split his time between Europe and America, which I think has been the downfall for a lot of players over the last 10 years. And I think that decision's really helped him to kick on.
You mentioned the European players, and you know, three European winners on the PGA Tour in a row, I think. McIlroy, Molinari, and now Casey. How strong a case is there, if you pardon the expression, for there to be a European winner at the US Masters in Augusta next month?
I think there's a big chance. I think you look at the world rankings at the moment, and I think it's six of the top 12 are American, and the other six are European. So there's quite a close split. I think you look at the out-and-out favourites are going to be Rory McIlroy and Dustin Johnson. So again, it's one from each side. But in behind them, there's a really good case for five or six Europeans, including Paul Casey, to have a really good run at it. So I think I wouldn't back that there'd definitely be a European winner, but I think you'll get a run for your money. I think there'll be a couple involved come Sunday evening.
In terms of British chances, you know, if you look at the top 20 at the moment, that you mentioned McIlroy and Rose and Casey, Tommy Fleetwood's in there as well. Which of those do you think has the best record? Do you buy any of this? McIlroy hasn't got the bottle to win the Masters and he's destined for top 10s for the rest of his career?
No, I think Rory McIlroy is more than capable of winning the Masters. I think he probably will win the Masters at some stage. It's a tournament where you get the same names on the leaderboard every year. Augusta either suits your eye or it doesn't. And he's proved that he can play that course. He's come close to winning there a couple of times. So I think he probably will win there eventually. But it's not easy. There's a really big group of players. It's not like 20 years ago when Tiger Woods just had to beat Ernie Els and Vijay Singh and he was pretty much guaranteed a trophy. There are 10, 12, 15 players who turn up every week expecting to win now, and you have to be right on top of your game to get over the line.
One player who can't turn up and expect to win every week at the moment is Luke Donald, but it was nice to see him back up the right end of the leaderboard again. You know, similarly came through that generation, like Casey, a former world number one. He's obviously had a lot of problems with injury, but do you feel that he is getting close to his best again now?
Well, there's a long way back for Luke Donald. I think before last week he was ranked 911th in the world, which shows just how far he's fallen, because it doesn't seem that long ago that I was there at Wentworth when he beat Lee Westwood in a playoff to become world number one for the first time. And he looked like a guy with the world at his feet who'd put his wrist problems behind him and was about to go on and contend for majors, and it just never quite happened for him. And the back problems, you only have to see what the back problems have done to Tiger Woods. It can be career-ending as a golfer. There's so much strain on your back. And it's great to see him playing again and playing well. And hopefully, like Casey, he can have a sort of golden couple of years in his 40s where he contends, picks up another couple of titles.
Do you think, I mean, I sort of look at it and think that, I mean, it's obvious because Luke's been out for so long and been struggling for so long, but Paul, to me, seems like the more likely, and maybe has the game set up a little bit better to win the majors when you look at the courses they're being played on at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Paul Casey's someone who, you know, if you told me in 12 months' time that he's won a major, I wouldn't be at all surprised. I think he'll come close in a couple of them and he'll give you a good run for your money. Luke Donald has the first problem that he can't get into the fields at majors because of his ranking. He's only played one in the last 3 or 4 years. Hopefully that can turn around for him and he can get back in. You'd think his best chance would probably be at an Open Championship over a links setup where he might give it a run for his money. I think Augusta's always going to be too long for him. And PGAs are played on difficult courses. Possibly a very difficult US Open, but like I say, it's all about trying to get back in the fields for him first, because you can't win it if you're not in it.
No, you've got to build a way back up. Dave, thanks very much for your insight on that. That's Dave Clark, sports journalist with Press Association Sports.
Love Sport.
Now it's time to talk a bit of goalkeeping. Rich Lee, Love Sport's goalkeeping expert and host of the Goalkeepers Union podcast, is on the line. Rich, what did you make of Jordan Pickford's performance in goal on Friday? There was a little bit of pressure on him, wasn't there?
There was, yeah, no, certainly in the build-up to the game. Also from the media, he didn't seem like he showed any signs of nervousness or pressure at all. He was very cool, calm, collected. Thought his distribution was very good. He wasn't overly worked, but he was effective in what he did. I was impressed. Certainly given some of the scrutiny that he's had over the last week, I thought we might see some more signs of nervousness, but he looked great.
You mentioned his distribution there. One thing he probably can say that he has that the others don't, i.e. Butland and Tom Heaton, is that excellent distribution. How much of a playmaker do you think he can and should be?
It's becoming more and more, and it's interesting. Like a game like that is a perfect example where Jordan Pickford is still the best goalkeeper in England, for England, because you make the point there, and the word playmaker is very rare that you would associate the word playmaker with a goalkeeper, but certainly in Jordan's case, I think it's fair, because he's got, you know, to use a golf analogy, he's got every different club in the bag. For the way in which England play and the speed at which England play, you know, they're so dynamic in their play, so dynamic in their movement, to be able to get it back to front as quickly as he does, but also have the ability to play into fullbacks, into wingers, into midfield, and have the confidence to do it, which certainly with Jordan, confidence is never lacking. And you know, on the back of, he has had a few poor performances lately, but he certainly didn't show any of that in the game the other day, and he is becoming more of a playmaker for England.
And do you think that'll sort of translate down, let's say Pickford has a big injury, or if he does completely fall out of favour, do you think it'll be that Southgate goes, well, actually, I'm not going to pick Tom Heaton because his distribution isn't as good, and I will look to try and find another goalkeeper in a similar mould?
Quite possibly, and this is where, I mean, it's interesting in England because it's starting to happen now. We're seeing the next generation of goalkeepers come through. So the likes of, I mean, as good as Tom Heaton is, and it's a great example, Tom Heaton, Joe Hart, there's certain similarities where it was, they're not quite as good as Jordan Pickford is with his feet. You could argue that then Alisson and certainly Ederson might even be the next level to where Jordan Pickford is. It's this next band of goalkeepers that's coming through. So obviously the likes of Angus Gunn, Jack Butland, obviously similar age to Jordan. The likes of Nick Pope, again, similar age. So it's in the band under that that's coming through. And that'll be where it's a Dean Henderson or a Freddie Woodman. They're probably the next two. But I would say they're not going to be ready for Euro 2020. We're probably talking the next World Cup where we might see a serious challenge from the likes of Henderson, from the likes of Freddie Woodman in particular, and then Angus Gunn as well.
Now, talking of goalkeepers playing with their feet, Thibaut Courtois has not always been the best at it, and he showed, I mean, it was a massive error he made for Belgium at the weekend, wasn't it?
It was, and you know, it was, I mean, look, he's not had his best season, I'm sure he would admit that. And it was an odd one, really. The ball's come into him, and he just did not want to use his right foot. It just seemed like he was trying to do everything with his left foot, and he made a real hash of it. And in the end, it, you know, looked a bit silly. And I've seen some of the memes and other bits and pieces that have gone out since. You know, he did look like Bambi on ice, unfortunately. But he, yeah, really tripped over himself, and obviously it was a poor error. But look, it happens to every goalkeeper. I think the key lesson there, and the key lesson for a young goalkeeper listening in, is to have the ability to play with both feet. If you needed an example of it, that was it there. Well, you receive it on your left, take it over to your right, and then you have the ability to either play out or go long. And he's obviously tried to do everything with his left, and unfortunately he tripped over himself.
Do you think there's an element as well of, you know, I'm sure that 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, Thibaut Courtois would have put his left foot through that ball and would have gone 80 yards up the other end of the pitch, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would, and that's not acceptable now. That's the problem for a lot of goalkeepers. You know, if we go back to Jordan Pickford, I'm sure if we looked at his stats from the other night, he kept possession 80%, 90% of the time, which, of course, then gives England the opportunity to build attacks. Their first goal was 20-plus passes. You know, it's a great example of where they need to be keeping possession in order to build those attacks. The goalkeeper now that goes long, it's a real safe way of doing it as a goalkeeper, because you're never going to get blamed if you punt it long every single time. You don't really put yourself up for any type of risk. But the problem is, from your manager's point of view, from your team's point of view, you never keep possession of the football. So you're not effective enough for your team. But you're right, 10 years ago, no one would have even considered that point of view. All they would have thought about was get it away from danger. A goalkeeper's job is to get it away from danger. The problem is now, for goalkeepers, you are now becoming more of a playmaker. So you have to be so good with your feet. The job spec has changed.
Now, in the goalkeeping section of the England squad, Jack Butland. Some people criticise his call-up because he's obviously playing in the Championship. I know Southgate this week has said he basically won't pick Jack Grealish at the moment because it's very hard to tell how well he's actually playing because he's playing the Championship. But if we say that that doesn't matter, there's one player who can feel hard done by because he's not in the England squad, which is James Shea. Luton Town's goalkeeper has 18 clean sheets in 35 League One appearances this year. Rich, have you spotted much of him on your radar?
Yeah, I've watched him a few times, and I'm delighted for him because he's not your stereotypical goalkeeper. What I mean by that is he's probably, I think he's probably about 5'11".
5'11", sure. Bang on. I've looked that up for you, Rich. You are absolutely right.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Although, if he's like me, he might have changed his Wikipedia to 6'2". But
that is so petty, Rich. Come on. You've never done that.
Hey, you got to do what you got to do. I remember when I signed for Brentford, actually, when I went and met the manager, I wore Timberlands and I had inner soles to give me an extra 2 inches in height. But you got to do what you got to do.
Right, okay.
I'm delighted for him because he's not your stereotypical goalkeeper in that sense, but when I've watched him, technically, great technician, distributes the ball very well, just very solid in everything he does. And look, Luton's rise has been absolutely phenomenal. No one would have predicted this. And certainly from James Shea's point of view, he's not a goalkeeper that you'd have had down as being, say, the top goalkeeper in League One. But this season, he has been so consistent. You can count the number of errors he's made comfortably on one hand, barely any errors at all. And it's great to see that. Also in League One as well, the Barnsley goalkeeper, Adam Davis, made his debut for Wales. So it's just nice to see that goalkeepers in League One are getting some of the credibility that they deserve. And certainly from James Shea's point of view, it might be the case that, and he's certainly been in non-league, he was at Arsenal as a kid, he's played a lot of non-league football, there is a very good chance he could be a Championship goalkeeper next season.
And do you think, even at the age of 27, if he were to go into the Championship and play well next year, do you think even that, having never really been involved in the England setup, he could reasonably say, look, I should be getting a chance at least to come up as the third goalkeeper and show what I can do in the international squad?
In the Championship, no. Do you know the difficulty is, and this is where it makes no sense, but this is how football works. At his age, clubs won't see him with a resale value, so no one's going to buy him. So he's not going to get bought from the Premier League. So he'll have to get promoted with a team. You've got to find the right vehicle, you've got to play, and you've got to get promoted. So look, if Luton got themselves promoted this season, then got themselves promoted again, and he managed to keep his place in the team, then yes, there might be somebody considering from England. I mean, the chances of it happening are so, so small. For a start, Luton going up. For a start, Luton might even look to find another number one next season if they're in the Championship, because we see how quickly teams change their entire team, as Fulham have done this season, when they get promoted. So I mean, look, it's very, very unlikely, but this is what dreams are made of, right? You know, a 27-year-old that's been in non-league a lot of his career. Nick Pope was at Bury Town after getting released as a kid, and all of a sudden he's in the England squad. So it can happen. It's very unlikely, but that's what keeps a lot of the goalkeepers going, is the thought that just maybe they could get there one day.
Richard Lee, keeping your and my dreams alive. Thanks very much for coming on, Rich. As always, that's Love Sport's goalkeeping expert, Richard Lee, former Watford and Brentford stopper. He's also host of the excellent Goalkeepers Union podcast. Search Goalkeepers Union wherever you get your podcasts to listen into that.
This is Love Sport.
Ronnie O'Sullivan is back to world number one. Now, I don't think there's any question that he's the best snooker player in the world, frankly, because he's played about half the number of tournaments anyone else has, and he's still managed to make his way up to the top of the rankings. Let's face it, he's always been world number one. I don't think there's any question of that. He moved back to the top of the rankings last night with a 13-11 win over Neil Robertson in Llandudno. It's hardly the most glamorous venue in the world, but nevertheless, a tournament with 8 top players. Remember that Neil Robertson himself has been world number one. He's also been world champion. So it's not a win or a tournament that we should be sniffing at too much, wherever the snooker table happened to be. Ronnie had to fight as well, by the way. It wasn't plain sailing by any stretch. Sometimes when you watch O'Sullivan, you know, the Rocket, as they call him, he plays so quickly, you just think it's easy for him, and he just seems to breeze through the game, and he just brushes aside opponents. But Robertson really took him down to the wire. He was 5-3 down overnight, but got level at 8-all, and then at 10-all, first at 13, of course. But I think, crucially, Robertson never actually got ahead, and that was a sign of a little bit of consistency from O'Sullivan. And that's what I wanted to talk about, really, is that consistency is not a word we've always associated with Ronnie. He openly admitted afterwards that he didn't really care about the number one spot in the rankings. He's not driven by it. if I was, he says, I'd probably enter a few more tournaments. And that's absolutely true. Rankings, to a certain extent, in all these individual sports, are dictated by how many points you rack up, by going to all these tournaments, reaching semi-finals and finals on a consistent basis. It's a testament to Ronnie's form that he doesn't have to do that, and he still gets to the top of those rankings. He did it last night as well. He had to grind his way past Robertson. He's played 9 tournaments this season. He's reached 7 finals. Isn't that ridiculous? He's only played 9 tournaments, been in 7 finals, and he's won 5 of them. That is a heck of a strike rate. He didn't even play well that last night, I think. He was all right. And a break of 89 in the 24th frame gave him the 13-11 win. Got the job done, really. And that's perhaps what he wouldn't have done, I think, 10 years ago. We've all seen Ronnie lose matches in all different manners of ways, sometimes getting outplayed, but he is without a doubt the most talented snooker player, I think, of all time. And in his younger days, he was constantly trying to play the perfect game of snooker, which is not always possible. It's also not an uncommon trait for the very best in any sport to constantly be striving for perfection. Roger Federer, I think, basically, or at least he was when he was a little bit younger, never satisfied with his performance. He was always trying to play the perfect game of tennis. I think he could win 6-love, 6-love and not lose a point and still say, oh, well, I didn't quite hit the line on this serve, or actually that backhand winner was maybe a little bit conservative and I could have played a different shot. That's what drives them on. When you're winning, when you've won so much, you need to have an internal drive, something that says, you can be better, you can be better. And Ronnie was the same. And when that perfection, like a pane of glass, one chip, and all of a sudden it's no longer ready and it just shatters, he would sometimes just walk out. You know, we've seen him do it several times. He'd concede eminently winnable frames or even matches in a sort of diva style. Now, part of that, we know, was due to the mental distress that he was undergoing. His battle with depression has been a very public one. But it's also because of the type of sportsman he is. And I think those two things are linked. If you are that type of sportsman who has been so successful, but who wants to keep going, you need that voice in your head that says, come on, you can do more, you can do better. But that can be a negative as well as a positive force, because it says to you, you're not good enough. You're not, you know, as soon as that turns around, stops being, you can be better, and starts being, you're not the best you can be. That's not good enough. Why aren't you better? That's when it becomes very, very destructive. Now, Ronnie's success last night ties him with Stephen Hendry's record of 36 ranking titles. He could surpass that at the World Championships that starts in Sheffield on April 20th. And I think it would be pretty fitting if he reinforced his place, because I think he already is snooker's greatest player. But he could reinforce his place at the biggest tournament with a 6th title at the Worlds by overtaking Stephen Hendry. In spite of all that, he's never won, and this is a funny one, he's never won BBC Sports Personality of the Year. He's never even been in the top 3, actually. Now, don't tell me that he should always win it because he's got the most personality. Just, if you have to, if you're going to be so dull as to say, oh, but it's BBC Sports Personality and he's got the most personality, that's not what it means. It was a word in the 50s that didn't have the same meaning. Just imagine, if you have to, that it's BBC Sports Person of the Year. You happier now? Producer Ben looks much happier. He was very confused before. So only one snooker player has ever won it, by the way, and it's Steve Davis in 1988, who really doesn't have a personality. So if anything proves that BBC Sports Personality of the Year is about being a sports person, not a personality, that's it. But if Ronnie does win the world and overtake Stephen Hendry, will he be recognised? Well, probably not, actually, because if he's not won it by now, he's hardly likely to again. The public have always, I think, struggled to believe that snooker's a proper sport. You know, just because of the nature, you play it in a bow tie and trousers and, you know, a little bit like darts. People always struggled. It's a pub game, they say. But look, in terms of importance to an individual sport and a career of achievement, O'Sullivan is pretty unrivaled, I think. There was just under £400,000 of prize money on the line in North Wales this week in Llandudno. Without O'Sullivan having ever existed, I don't think that figure would either have been dreamt of at that tournament in North Wales. It would have been an absolute fraction of that. So Ronnie doesn't really need BBC Sports Personality of the Year to validate him. I get that. But maybe this is the year that we should give him the award anyway. It's not a World Cup year. It's not Olympic year. This might be his chance, even if only to recognise what has been a staggering career of achievement.
This is Love Sport.
Now, England romped to a 5-0 win over the Czech Republic at Wembley on Friday night, but it will be altogether more difficult for them. Tonight, they take on Montenegro in Podgorica. And to talk about that is former England and Tottenham midfielder Paul Stewart. Paul, how impressed were you with England on Friday night?
Well, they mightily impressed, if I'm honest. I didn't expect them to win so convincingly, especially with such a young side out, if I'm honest. I shouldn't be surprised, really, because of how well they did in the summer. But, you know, they did have a few changes in there, but they disposed of them very, very easily.
Were you pleased to see so many young faces involved as well? There was something, a few people saying that perhaps Southgate should have been trying to sow a bit more experience in the squad, but would you actually almost want all the youngsters out there?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an argument of, you know, the experience side of it, but you don't get experience without playing.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's a chicken and egg scenario, and I think it's very brave to play the youngsters, especially when you look at it, that they're not getting game time at their own clubs, and then as tonight will prove with Adoy, that they're not even getting game time at their own clubs yet. They're going on the international stage.
That is remarkable, isn't it? To see Callum Hudson-Odoi, we understand he's going to start this evening. Doesn't start at Chelsea. Do you think he should be thinking about it, and maybe the start will spark it into his mind that maybe he should go and try and play somewhere else so that he can play first team football?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, listen, he was wanting to leave to go and play first team football in Germany, and it never transpired. And you do need to play in week in, week out, I believe, if you are playing at international level. So he probably will look at it now that he becomes a full international, and maybe he'll knock on the manager's door first and foremost and ask about playing at Chelsea. But other than that, it's very important for his development that he gets game time. Otherwise, he'd probably find himself not in future England squads because he's purely and simply due to the fact that he's not playing, which...
Well, Gareth Southgate said that he'd spoken to Maurizio Sarri and says he understands how highly Sarri rates him and how much he trusts him. But as a player, it must be difficult to think that a manager does rate you and trust you if he won't play you. They can only say it so much, right? The actions speak louder than the words.
Yeah. And you know, we'll see tonight how he gets on the field. And Gareth seems to be doing a remarkable job. And, you know, it wouldn't be for me to criticise any of the decisions. He's in contact with the managers of the Premiership clubs where his players are. He seems to be able to manage the youngsters when they come in and make sure that he does the right thing by them. So, you know, I wouldn't like to question any of his decisions with his players because of the results that he's managed to dig out. Well, not dig out, but, you know, to get for the country, which is what we want, don't we? We want people upbeat about our country's national team.
yeah, quite. Now, we saw Declan Rice make his England debut, albeit not his international debut. We all know about that. But there's a lot of talk that he is starting to overtake and perhaps already has overtaken Eric Dier in that deep-lying holding midfielder role. If you had to sort of pick one now, would you still be picking Dier or has maybe the torch been passed on?
It's a tough one, that. I mean, Eric Dier isn't guaranteed a first-team place at Spurs, is he, at the moment? Declan has come in and been a revelation. I think, perhaps on form, you would say Declan Rice, but Eric Dier does perform when he plays for England. Again, it's a headache for the manager, but it's a good headache when you've got two players that sort of play the same way and both top quality at doing so. So that's the sort of decisions that come your way when you're an England manager, isn't it?
Yes, that's why they're paid the big bucks, I believe.
That's right.
You mentioned that we want people to be positive about playing for their country, and something that we were talking about last week was a large number of players pulling out of the squad with what seemed like minor injuries. You obviously had a couple of England caps, and I'm sure they're extremely valuable to you. Does it then sting a bit to see players picking and choosing when they play for their country?
I think so, yeah. And I think you're always going to have the age-old debate of club and country, aren't you? We're at a pivotal point in the Premiership season. But that said, the Euro qualifiers are mightily important as a nation. It really is a difficult. I would hope that players are not pulling out for genuine reasons. I don't see why one would when they've got the chance to play for their country. I would sincerely hope that isn't the case. But that said, they're going to have potential injuries that they've played with such a grueling Premiership, and especially at that level because they're playing Champions League. So you look at, so, you know, Man City, for instance, and Raheem Sterling, you know, he's in four competitions. So you've got to look at the potential rest that they do need for fear of serious injury. So it is a fine balance, but I would be disappointed if players are pulled out or feigned injuries because they don't want to turn up and play for England.
Did you ever hear of it happening in your career? Maybe not with England, maybe with other countries. Was there ever someone in the squad who went, I don't think I'm going to go and play for whoever it happens to be this week? Or was that just not even something people were thinking about in that era?
I don't think players did. I never came across anyone saying, "Oh, we're playing away in such a place that you haven't heard of, so I'm not going." I never heard of it happening. I know that managers, and we remember the arguments that managers had about club and country, that the clubs paid the wages. I think Sir Alex was one that was vocal about this, but you know, we should have passed that problem by now. And I think as a player, if you don't want to pull your country shirt on, then you've got to question whether you're in the right sport, in my opinion.
Yeah, quite. Now, I just want to change tack briefly because you will have seen yesterday, of course, the big test event at the new Spurs Stadium. I mean, just looking at photos and watching videos, it does look magnificent. How excited are you for Spurs to finally get into their new home?
Oh, God, it's been a long time coming, and now they've got, we're going to be in April when the actual first team play there, I think. They've had one really good event. They've got the Legends game this weekend. I mean, by all accounts, it's a fantastic stadium. It's going to be great for the club, great for the players. I think teams that have got to go there are going to look forward to playing at this stadium that's been spoken about. So it's all got so many plus points, but it's just been, you know, an age waiting to return home, if you will. Because I don't think the fans ever thought that Wembley was home. No. I went to a few games there, a few league games, and the empty seats that you could see clearly. And you know, a football club wants its home ground, doesn't it? And I know that the fans, because of social media, are so excited about going back, and I think it'll lift Spurs maybe to stay in the Champions League spot.
Well, yeah, I mean, I've just been recently offered a ticket to the first game in the new spot, Tottenham Stadium, and I have completely rearranged my diary so that I can make it, and I'm not even a Spurs
Brilliant.
Fan, so
I don't. That's great.
I don't even know what Tottenham fans must be feeling.
Paul,
thank you so much for coming on. Always an absolute
pleasure
to speak to you. Cheers. That's Paul Stewart, former Tottenham and Man City and England, of course, forward.
Love Sport.
Scotland are, and I've said this before, in crisis. There's no question of that. Scotland have been in crisis so many times in my lifetime, and I spent half my life living in Scotland. I used to go and watch Scotland fairly regularly. But that 3-0 defeat to Kazakhstan, and there's a lot of competition for the title of worst ever Scottish footballing performance, but I think that might be it. The writing was very much on the wall as well, by the way. Kieran Tierney, probably Scotland's best player, or maybe second best player, pulled out with an injury. Definitely Scotland's best player, Andy Robertson. He had surgery on a tooth abscess instead of flying to Almaty. The three goalkeepers had just two senior caps between them. Jordan Archer at Millwall probably would have played, but he was out with illness. Johnny Russell was needed so badly that he flew 8,000 miles from Kansas, where he plies his trade, just to make a substitute appearance, which had very little impact. But for then, you know, it's all very well saying, oh, yeah, there's so many things could go wrong for Scotland tonight. It's all going to happen. For that to actually be realised on a plastic pitch and in indoor conditions, it was particularly grim. I mean, you have to laugh, otherwise you'll cry. It was awful for a Scotland fan, and I do regard myself as one. Scotland kind of relish, it's a weird mindset in all Scottish sports teams, I think. Scotland relish the lack of pressure that the underdog tag affords them. And it seems to be true across all sorts of sports. I always said of the Scottish rugby team that they were favourites, but it was being favourites was the worst thing they could possibly be. To the extent that actually they really are favourites because the better team was at such a disadvantage. It's the same with cricket as well. I used to cover Scottish cricket, and if they were playing, I don't know, UAE or perhaps some country where they've only recently learnt the sport, I was always a bit nervous about what they might manage. But put them in against England or Australia, and I thought, yeah, they might actually give them a go here. And we saw that last summer when they beat England at the Grange. The footballers seem to have the same thing. There are so many scars of previous defeats or draws or miserable performances on every player. And they were there. They were obvious in San Marino. Andy Robertson said as much. And look, the Tartan Army are some of the best supporters in the world, but even they've reached the end of their tether after a meagre 2-0 win over the world's worst team, San Marino. It's hard when you just had that defeat to go out and play confidently or fluently, and they didn't, frankly. And Alex McLeish, of course, the Scotland manager, he said that he's not surprised by the reaction of the fans.
It really set us back in that whole game, and I think it left a few of us shell shocked, you know, but we dealt with the second game, if not fantastically, but it was professional enough.
It's hard, I don't deny, that off the back of that defeat, going into a game where you know the opposition aren't going to offer anything. It's like if you're a batsman and you're out of form, and they bring on the slow medium pacer on a tough wicket. You've got to put all the pace on the ball. Everything feels alien. It's a difficult situation. You just don't want to be there. And it's so hard to achieve anything. You just want to get out. But they're the situations when top-level coaching is required, right? Scotland are never going to have the best talent. We know that. It's a small country with a horrendous obesity and alcoholism record. But that doesn't mean that they can't be successful. It's a mindset thing. It really is. Look at Iceland or Denmark when they won the Euros. It is possible. But so much defeatism. You know, listening to Alex McLeish say, we were a wee bit nervy, it's been a tough few days for everyone, we're shell-shocked. These are not things that I want a Scotland manager to be saying in this situation. I want them to be come out and say, you know, we've learnt from that. We understand the mistakes we've made. We're going to improve. I know this team are good enough to improve. Andy Robertson is probably the best Scottish player I've seen for a long time. And look, he is an incredible young lad. He's come from almost nowhere in the last 5 years. And he should be someone that these coaches are excited about working with. And they're not. They sit there and just go, oh, well, you know, we got the job done against San Marino. San Marino, none of whom are full-time footballers, whose best player plays for Crotone in Serie B. You talk about Callum Hudson-Odoi having never started a top-flight game before his England debut. None of these San Marino players have ever played a top-flight game. And Scotland are going saying, we got the job done. By winning 2-0 there. Obviously, it was very important, Alex McLeish said, that we won the game and dealt with it. Look, Alex McLeish himself is worried, and rightly so. Former Scotland midfielder Billy Dodds, he said that McLeish may only have a couple of games left.
I think a lot of them, not them all, but I would say a good percentage of them have made their mind up about Alec, and they let it be known last night to not just Alec, the board as well. The players got some as well, so that's where the Tartan Army are at.
He's right, they are frustrated, and look, the Tartan Army follow Scotland all over the world and spend a huge amount of money doing so, and they are very loud usually, and their support is pretty unrivalled, I think. But when you look at the coaches, and look, if Alex McLeish does lose his job, and I'm not saying I want him to, but after Scotland plays Cyprus in June, they then got Belgium, Russia and Belgium again. I don't think you'd expect them to get anything out of those games. Russia, by the way, beat Kazakhstan 4-0 away from home the other night. It doesn't bode well for Scotland, does it? If you look at the next appointment they make, the list of coaches that Scotland have been through, in reverse order, is McLeish, Gordon Strachan, who claimed that Scotland were genetically disadvantaged, i.e. we're too small to compete on the world level. Craig Levine, hardly many achievements on a high level. George Burley, whose win percentage at Scotland was 21%. Alex McLeish again. Walter Smith, What have they ever achieved? What have these people ever achieved? Why are they getting the jobs? Is it because the SFA is saying, well, we've pretty much got to get someone Scottish because, you know, we had Bertie Vogts for so long and he wasn't successful? No, that's madness. How are we still so backwards thinking in the way we make our appointments? If we think, well, look, there aren't any good Scottish coaches, or there aren't enough good Scottish coaches, or, you know what, no one stands out, why not think outside the box? Why not say to someone, look, you're a young, successful, innovative coach, come to Scotland, revamp the whole way we do everything. We've clearly got a problem from top to bottom. Come and do what Conor O'Shea's done with rugby in Italy and work as the top national coach, but revamp everything that we do. Scotland cannot continue like this. It's been going on for years and they have to somehow stop the rot.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.